80 years ago, Amelia Earhart and her navigator Fred Noonan disappeared over the Pacific Ocean without a trace. All over the world lie scattered pieces of her puzzle, waiting to be put together. Welcome to the Chasing Earhart podcast. I'm your host and the project creator, Chris Williamson. Hello and welcome to the Chasing Earhart podcast. I am your host and the project creator, Chris Williamson. This is episode 16. We are coming to you live from the birthplace of Amelia Earhart, Atchison, Kansas. We are just a few blocks away from the house that Amelia Earhart grew up in. It's a very big honor and privilege for us to record from this location. Atchison, Kansas really does carry the soul and the spirit of Amelia Earhart, and we have been recording the podcast here in Atchison for the last several episodes, so we're very happy to be here, and we're very happy to record in this great town. Now, we are recording this episode on November 11th, which happens to be Veterans Day. Just before we begin the show, I want to begin by saying thank you to all the veterans, men and women alike. I know we have a lot of veterans involved in the project. It's an absolute honor and a privilege to be working with all of you folks, and we're indebted to you forever. So happy Veterans Day. Thank you very much. Okay, now on to this week's guest. We talked about him last week. Our guest this week is Ron Bright. He's a very well-respected Amelia Earhart researcher. He's been doing this a very long time. We've brought Ron in to sort of go broad spectrum on the Amelia Earhart disappearance investigation and talk with him about several of the varying hypotheses and his own personal research. It's a really interesting interview. We speak with him about a lot of varying topics, and it's not often that we get to go broad spectrum with the guests, so this is a real treat for us, and we hope that you guys really enjoy it. So without further ado, I'm proud to present Ron Bright. Our guest today for the Chasing Earhart podcast is a gentleman who is very widely respected within the Earhart research community. It's someone who I've been actually wanting to speak to since the very beginning of the actual project, way back in 2008, 2009 when I was doing research. This is one of the gentlemen I wanted to speak to. His name is Ron Bright. Ron, it's an absolute honor to have you on the show today. Thank you so much for the time.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
So, Ron, what I'd like to do, if it's okay with you, is just have you give the folks out there that are listening to the podcast a little bit of information about your education and your professional background, please.
Well, let me tell you how I got started with the Earhart mystery. I spent 29 years with NCIS, Naval Criminal Investigative Service, as a federal agent, then about 10 years as a criminal defense attorney, and investigator, and in 2000 I retired from that active duty and was looking around for something that might be worthwhile for fresh eyes, as they say, and about that time Tiger's group, Gillespie was out, and that was an enthralling theory, and I hooked onto that, and from there in 2000 until the last couple of years, I spent a lot of time and energy going back over the research that had already been done by some well-established researchers in the professional field. I'm really just an amateur.
Well, what was that like for you? I mean, it's a good segue to the next question, because you've really, as you just stated, you've kind of went over the research that a lot of other folks have been doing and just kind of proofreading, so to speak, and just kind of going through everything. What's that process like for a lot of the young folks out there that are following the project and just kind of researching and kind of going over other folks' work like that? How does that work?
Well, there's a lot of material out there, and you know, much of it is contained in books and references and so forth, and it's very difficult, particularly a case this old, to do any original research with live witnesses. Back in 17 years ago, I ran into two or three that were still alive that were available for an interview, such as
So let me ask you this, because it's just a fun question to ask. What are your earliest recollections of Amelia Earhart? Do you remember hearing about her growing up, and you know, what was that like for you? What were your earliest memories of that? Yeah, I mean, I always ask folks, you know, what brought him into all this stuff. I mean, I know you kind of, you touched on it a little bit, but what do you think drives you personally, or what drove you back when you first got into it to want to investigate this? Is it just kind of the nature of the mystery of this woman and this man, Mr. Noonan, of course, is involved as well, just kind of disappearing without a trace? And what is it about that case that just kind of compelled you to want to get involved? You know, it's interesting because there's, as you mentioned, there are so many different hypotheses out there. When you're looking at all this work, I mean, there's the data is so prominent out there for everybody that's working.
Huge.
Yeah, it really is huge. How do you compartmentalize, and how do you break things down when you're looking at something? How do you determine, you know, what is not maybe relevant data, what should be substantial data, what deserves a second look? How does that process work for you? Right.
The fuel consumption. You know, the researchers have got her dead empty at 9 o'clock, and others have at 9 o'clock on 2 July, 9 a.m., and others have maybe 2-3 hours left.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's interesting. It's you know, it's been argued by me that there's so many different rabbit holes to go down when it comes to Amelia Earhart. I mean, you've got It's interesting. I was just talking with Scott Philbrook and Forrest Burgess on their show the other day, the Astonishing Legends show, and we were talking about Earhart and the project and all that good stuff. And one of the things we discussed was, you know, almost every one of these various hypotheses that are out there almost have sub-hypotheses underneath them, you know, depending on who you believe and what route you want to take. If you look at, say, the Japanese capture hypothesis, that's sort of like an umbrella, and then under that umbrella there's multiple different routes that you could take to go down depending on who you want to listen to or who you want to believe. It seems like it's a really in-depth amount of work to kind of go through. I imagine for someone like yourself who's just kind of trying to look at all of it, it can be quite daunting.
Well, as an example, you can take the interviews and newspaper accounts of Josephine, which really set this thing off.
Right.
And you can spend months analyzing what she said as compared to what her mother reported, what her son-in-law reported, and other people. I mean, it is a very complicated issue. And like Warner said, could there be alternative explanations of her observations? And that's what kicked off the Saipan theory.
Mm-hmm.
The other theory followed by Tiger has been the line of position, which intersected, if you went south the 380 miles, you'd go into the Phoenix Islands.
Mm.
And that's what initiated his inquiries down there.
Yeah.
Of course, the love to mother, which he used as a salutation, was fascinating for me because somebody had to be responsible for writing that telegram unsigned that was received by the State Department. So that was my original interest. Who wrote that? The telegram was addressed to George Putnam at his Hollywood address. Who would know that? Well, they said only Amelia Earhart would know that. And then they said, well, she must have been at Waishan, prison camp, civilian prison camp.
Right.
But that broke down when we went back and talked to camp administrators and camp people that were at the camp and so forth. Was Earhart the comatose patient lying in the Japanese section and so forth? It's an interesting story, and that was the kind of thing that got me involved further to take a look at some of these other theories.
Well, and you know, let's talk about that for the folks out there that are listening to this episode of the podcast. What Ron is alluding to here is the Waishan telegram, and I'll give you a little bit of exposition, and then we'll get Ron to go into it a little bit more. But this notion sprang from, I think, a letter that was or something that was discovered around 1987. It was in the State Department archives, and it was it was an unsigned telegram or a speed letter back in those days, and it was addressed to Mr. Putnam from Waishan in 1945, and Amelia Earhart was soon "quote unquote" identified as its sender,
that was the original interpretation.
Yeah, and so for the folks out there that are listening, the unsigned telegram reads: "It's very short, but I'm going to quote it. It's a quote: Camp liberated, all well, volumes to tell, love to mother." And so that's essentially the the telegram. Very short, just a few words. Ron, let's get into that. So tell me kind of how you touched on it already a little bit, but can you kind of break down that telegram and why you feel that was eventually, debunked, so to speak?
Well, so here we have that unsigned telegram. So I said, let's take a look, and I went to the camp administrator in Vancouver, still living at that time. This was back in 2001, and he sent me maybe... 50 pages or more of some 1,900 people that authored telegrams.
Mm.
And all of them had that a short telegram. They were allowed something like 20 or 30 words. And out of that 2,000 or so telegrams, there were only two that used the phrase camp liberated.
Mm.
What did that mean? So I said, maybe there's somebody else that could be responsible besides Earhart.
Right.
You know,
Yeah.
So anyway, I looked into Putnam. Of course, he never responded to the State Department. He didn't believe it. That she was alive and that this was signed by, was coming from Earhart. He never paid any attention to it at all. And then it turns out, we then checked back on Putnam and his FBI files. It turns out that Putnam was closely acquainted and tried to recruit a spy, if you will, to spy on Japan back in 1936, I believe it was. And he eventually was identified. We finally found out that it was a guy named Kamal. And then we found out that Kamal had been imprisoned at the assembly camp, and he had befriended and Putnam knew who he was. He certainly knew he was with Putnam back in the Hollywood days, and he knew Putnam's Hollywood address. So it seemed to me it was pretty logical that he could be the author of that mystery telegram. Make a long story then, we talked to the son who recalled his father discussing that. Kamal, it turns out, was a rather famous figure in the Muslim world, and many of the prisoners there, or ex-prisoners that we talked to, certainly recalled Kamal was kind of a wild guy, and so they confirmed that Kamal was at Weissman. But none of the other stuff made sense that we could find out. A guy named a screenwriter later wrote a fiction book, but Hannon, he claimed that she was at the prison, but we could never verify that through other sources.
Was Hannon the guy that brought her back, or was Hannon the man who was responsible for bringing her back?
No.
Okay. Okay.
Hannon was just a screenwriter, wrote a couple of books and made a couple of claims, refuted by Pamela Masters, who wrote the Mushroom Years, the story of the Weishan. Hannon was, I think it was a fantasy of some sort, or who wanted to, that was something he was wishing for.
I see.
Because he thought that he had seen a comatose lady in the Japanese section at Weishan. Well, then we were wondering, I said, well, wait a minute, how would a comatose lady who was apparently flown, or was reportedly flown out, which we now know who it was, how would she write a rather complicated, how would she write a coherent sentence to her husband and know everything?
Right.
That didn't make sense.
Gotcha.
I don't like to dwell on it because I think that's not really a significant part today of the mystery.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, so let's move on. I'd like to educate folks and kind of, you know, get people to kind of hear these little known stories about Earhart, or, you know, maybe not about Earhart, but just it's kind of interesting that it's out there. But what I want to talk to you about is just kind of the official United States government explanation for Miss Earhart and Mr. Noonan and what happened. Essentially, they're, you know, they stand by the fact that they simply ran out of fuel. There was a series of errors, and they didn't have the fuel to make it, and they ran out and crashed and sank in sea. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, there never was. Like, today there would be an official, quote, unofficial, as Gillespie points, there never was really an official investigation. We have the captain of the Colorado and the other aircraft carrier and so forth, and the captain of the Itasca who wrote reports, and but they weren't, you know, officially gone over. We know that they chased around until the 19th of July looking for her, and they went as far south into the Phoenix. They went over to the Gilberts. They didn't go north to Mealy because nobody contemplated she had enough fuel at that point to get to Mealy.
Right.
So that was kind of the official end obviously one factor is no matter what amount of gas she had, she was going to run out of gas by noon of July 2nd.
Right.
She had to go down somewhere.
Right.
And that brings up the question, well, if she went down and they were authentic Ghost Lost messages, she had to be on land.
Yeah.
And the Tiger Group picked up on that. She had to be on land someplace or a reef or what have you. Either Winslow Reef or went down to the Phoenix. And then there was other, then the other people thought, well, wait a minute, she may have had enough gas to go up go to Mealy, where some merchants, years and years and years later, found, I think, one or two witnesses that saw a man, I believe, perhaps not, or like a woman, perhaps not the man, but they indicated that there was some activity of that nature on Mealy.
Yeah.
And it was picked up by people that believe that eventually the Japanese captured her at either Mealy or a nearby island, Jalowit, and then from Jalowit up to Kwajalein and to Saipan, where, as we all have seen in Rip Corner's books and all those witnesses, there was some indication that she was at Saipan, which was going back to Josephine Blanco.
Right.
And that's kind of what these various theories depended on. They had to depend on enough gas to get to south of the Phoenix, or maybe some believed she reversed course as she had stated and went back to the Gilberts.
Mm.
Although the Itasca went through the Gilberts, found no sign.
Yeah.
Never did find anything at all in the Gilberts. But then all of a sudden we started, later on, people started getting information from witnesses that they heard her after 9 o'clock. And that's still a contentious thing with researchers. Was she on land? Did she have the capability with that radio? Was she heard in St. Petersville, Florida? Was she heard by Wake and Hawaii and so forth? There were all kinds of triangulation and so forth that may or may not have got her to the Phoenix or to the Saipan area. And all of a sudden, you know, guys or researchers like Devine popped up and said, well, we found a briefcase that had some, looked like passports or other material. It was never clear what it was, but that initiated the and took hold as the survival at Saipan, as well as his sighting, he said, of the Electra that was seen flying over the airport just after the invasion had taken place. So that took a hold and was well written up by several researchers over there.
Yeah. So let's talk about, you know, the Japanese capture hypothesis and just as a whole. We'll just kind of go broad spectrum on it. But what are your thoughts on that hypothesis? First, did she in your opinion have enough fuel to get there? And secondly, what do you think happened? Do you think she there's a good chance that she ended up in the custody of the Japanese? Yeah.
Some researchers have interviewed the people on the Koshu, supposedly the ship that brought her, Japanese ship that brought her from Mealy to Jalowit, where they found one guy by the name of Diliman Amran.
Right.
Who said he treated a man and a woman on a ship. And that again ignited the fact that, well, she was en route to Saipan on the Japanese ship Koshu.
Yeah.
I've never seen any evidence that the Koshu reached Saipan, but that was the theory that the Kwajalein that she was eventually ended up at Saipan in the prison up there. that apparently came from a airplane that was struggling and landed in Tang Tang Harbor.
Yeah.
She didn't actually see it crash, but she saw two people that emerged on the beach. Dr. Sheff, who was well aware, you know, from the 43 movie, well aware that Earhart was in that area, he went in and got two pictures of Earhart and Noonan and displayed them to Josephine, and he said, well, does that look like him? Oh, yeah, that looks like him.
Hmm.
Anyway, a very weak identification, but yeah. I always thought that tainted her, over the years, her recollection of what they looked like.
Yeah. So let's talk about you know, we're kind of skipping around a little bit here, but that's okay. I want to discuss the Nikumaruro hypothesis with Gardner Island at the time. You know, you've mentioned you know, Mr. Gillespie a little bit here and there. What are, you know, I'll ask you kind of in the same vein as what I asked you about Japanese capture. What are the odds and what are the possibilities that she could have ended up, you know, as a castaway on Gardner Island? We'll call it Gardner for the sake of the time. Is that feasible? Is that possible? What are your thoughts on that from the research that you've done?
Well, if she has enough gas, she could, you know, to get I think it's about 300 miles south of Howland. If she had enough gas, it's conceivable she could have landed there. However, there's been no, as I say, indisputable evidence. Now, everything that Gillespie has found seems to have some tie to the 30s, whether it's a shoelace or a button or what have you. But we know that the Colorado sent three planes over Nikumaru on the 9th of July.
Yeah.
And they went very close. Weather was, but we have plenty of reports. Gillespie's read it. It's in spades with Lambrecht. And in fact, I talked to, Gillespie disputes this, but I did talk to one of the observers that was on a plane that went over, a guy by the name of Beckham, over with, Nikumaru. They went over at about 500 feet, and they saw no trace of Earhart. And believe me, they were well acquainted with their responsibilities as observers.
Yeah.
There was three in each plane. They went over and at a low altitude. They clearly recall seeing the Norwich City crater that crashed in 1929 at the end. So they didn't find anything. And then in October, Vaughn and Demington, two English guys, traipsed around the island about 3 months after July, I think it was October, and they traipsed around that island looking at for plantation purposes. They reported no signs, and they were aware of the possibility that she had gone down there. They didn't see anything, and they lit huge fires at night to keep the crabs away, and I always speculated that if they were in that area, Earhart and Noonan would come out and be rescued. But, so that didn't work.
Yeah.
Now they have the skeleton that they're going back with their own forensic people. I think there's some bias there, but they have remeasured and done anything, refocused on the type of measurements taken by Dr. Hoodless, who, when they found the pathologist that examined the bones that were dug up in 1940 by Gallagher in the spring of 1940, when they were springing, they found this skeleton. And so they're hanging their hats now on that those measurements might fit exactly Amelia Earhart.
Yeah.
Well, that's again a disputed notion that Hoodless, who thought he had Earhart's skull in his hand and bones, would not have. It's inconceivable to me that he would not have noted a Caldwell look. This is a sinus operation done in 35 on Earhart, in which they drilled two dime-sized holes in the maxilla.
Yeah.
As an identifying feature. And our research, which is extensive concerning the length of time that those sinus cavities would remain visible, indicated up to 3, 4, 5 years.
Right.
That could be plainly visible. So now his new forensic team has got to explain that. Why Hoodless did not note that in his medical examination. And besides that, we also know that I think there were 8 European sailors on the Norwich City that perished in that vicinity.
Yeah.
My guess, it was one of those guys that they found the skeleton. And that was the original description.
So... So we've kind of gone through we've kind of went broad spectrum here and gone through a few of the different hypotheses. There's one I want to talk about, you know, that we're going to be talking about in our project because I think it warrants it. And I just want to mention a name, and I just want you to give me your thoughts and your opinions on the name. And that name is Irene Bolam.
That theory was put to rest. I think you read our Atchison report. Irene Bolam. Not Amelia Earhart. Let me just make a declarative statement. Period.
Who was Irene Bolam then? I mean, was Irene Bolam, you know...
She was a real person, yeah. She married a guy named Bolam. Yeah, we have quite a biography. She was born up, I think, in Boston area, and so forth, was married. We thought that even her ex-husband said that was not... Amelia Earhart and so forth. Irene Bolam was a real person and had married a rich guy. I think her, you know, off the top of my mind, I think it was Irene Craigmile. Somebody.
Yeah, that's right.
And we researched where she lived, where she worked, and we have an extensive biography and covered all those bases.
Mm.
But, believe me, we talked to a couple of people that knew Earhart and Bolam. I talked to Eleanor Smith. She knew both of them. She said I had to look up to Amelia with Irene and look straight ahead.
Mm.
We figured Bolam, with the that we researched driver's license and passport, that she was 5'5", 5'5" and a half.
Yeah.
We have many pictures of people that were well over that when she took a trip to Europe with her cousin. She was short. She was like 5'5" and a half. Not short, but that's nothing like Earhart's 5'7" or 5'8". They just can't buy that she was. I can't buy the fact that where was she? Where was Amelia Earhart from 1937 until she emerged in 1942 or 5 when she Bolam emerged?
Was she at all connected to Amelia Earhart, Irene Bolam? Did she know her at all at any time? Is there anything that you found in your research that kind of could connect the two, even by 6 degrees of separation or anything like that? Or was it just completely not connected in any way, shape, or form?
Not connected. I can recall that Irene Bolam had any connection.
Hmm. Okay. So, I mean, I wanted to...
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, I wanted to talk about that because I think it warrants it, and I think it's you know, it's an important piece of you know, people need to hear about it. So,
I think you have to look at it, if I can interrupt. I think you have to look at our report I did with a couple of guys, Pat Gaston and Alex Mandel, of 6, 7, 8 pages, thoroughly going over all the Bolam issues, and that's called the Atchison Report. It's available on your computer.
Yeah, I have it. I think our team has a copy of it, yeah.
So I stand by that, and guys, why Amelia Earhart would then come back, want to be in a, witness protection program. Mm. God knows where she was in 37 until in the 40s, and why she would then go to a convention of women flyers, who was it in Long Island, when, what's his name, McCollison's friend?
Jervis. Joe Jervis?
Jervis, yes. Yeah. He looks across a crowded room, and he says, my God, there's Irene Bolam, there is Amelia Earhart.
Yeah. Well, so let's move on. I want to ask you. I want to ask you briefly. I just want to ask you bluntly, really. I mean, what, in your opinion, you've done all this research. You've looked at everything. With no objection, you're just kind of looking at it as data. What, in your opinion, after this time, what happened to Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan? What do you think actually happened to those two individuals?
Well, I think the secret is in her last radio transmissions, her voice has got louder and louder, as we well know, and they talk about all this skip and this and that, but Noonan was an expert. He could probably navigate by dead reckoning and get close to Howland. And the voices were heard at 8 o'clock by Bell Arts, the radio man, and the Kenner, the commander, very well, and at her last words, and I think you've heard this from the Bell Arts family, and from Long's research,
right,
that her last transmission seemed to mark some kind of anxiety, if you want.
Yeah.
There was no yelling or screaming, but there seemed to be a change in pitch or what have you at about that time, and when she indicated her last transmission was fear, she was on a line of position of 157 to whatever it was.
157337, yeah.
More transmission. Now, if she headed to Nicaragua or Relay, and her radio's been working for 12 or 20 hours.
Yeah.
Why didn't she signal, look, guys, I can't find you?
Right.
Because she thought they were on them. Remember, she related that. I think we're on you.
Right.
But if she had 4 hours to go to, or 3 hours to go to Neely, or 3 hours to go south to Chickamauga, why wouldn't she have stated, look, I can't find you guys. I'm going to take a chance and go down to the Phoenix or up north or to the Gilberts.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Why take off for 380 miles north, twice the equally difficult island to find?
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah. I think at that point, at 9 o'clock, she was at 1,000 feet or so, as she reported, and I think she went down twin engines, probably took her 2 or 3 seconds.
Mm.
She's in the water.
Let me ask you this. Do you think, I mean, there's been, as you know, as you're well aware, there's been multiple deep water searches that have been conducted in the last 20, 30 years. As a matter of fact, there was just one. Nauticos just got back not too long ago from recording. Do you think we'll ever find this plane? Is it even feasible if the plane goes down to 17,000, 18,000 feet and it's a...
I don't think so. Look at the search they did for that Malaysia flight. A huge airplane.
Yeah.
They dragged that ocean.
Yeah.
And that's a huge airliner.
Yeah.
Now we've got a small Lockheed Electra that went down and maybe 17,000 feet. Who knows if they've burst at the bottom. I mean, it doesn't bother me that they couldn't find it. They did search for surface. You know, somebody, they looked around for any surface and stuff that they floated up. But I think it went down. I know Nauticos and Long and these other people have made projections of where she may have gone down, but it would certainly take an extraordinary amount of money and time. And I don't think anybody's got the money to put in like millions to
do
a thorough search off within, say, 10 miles of where the possible splashdown. I don't know. I think it's gone forever.
You know, Ron, let me ask you this. I'm going to ask you just to speculate a little bit here, but you know, obviously you and I both know this is the 80th anniversary of Amelia and Fred's disappearance. People are as we just touched on, are still looking for her. The world is still very much invested in kind of the fate of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan and exactly what happened. I think everybody wants to put some kind of finality on this thing. Why do you think, you know, it is that the world continues to be fascinated by this case? It's the most fascinating missing persons case ever, really. Why does that continue to happen 80 years after they disappear? What do you think about that?
Well, she was probably the most famous person, the most famous photographed person, pioneer in the air business. I can think of who's the guy that jumped out of an airplane up here.
Oh, D.B. Cooper.
J.B. Cooper. I mean, that is fascinating. But Amelia Earhart, if you look, I think the interest is if you read her bios by Lavelle and some of these others, she was a woman way ahead in women's rights and equality in a man's world. And she had the charm and then later the guts to try the various flights. You know, she's in the same build as Lindbergh, same area as Lindbergh was. Look at how famous Lindbergh is. And,
yeah.
Earhart, I think, will live even stronger now because of the women's issues today.
Yeah. You know, any last words before we wrap this up, and any last thoughts that you want to convey on Amelia Earhart or your research or anything else?
Yes, I the other day I decided I'm going to find out what's missing. Is this a curse? Missing evidence.
Mm.
First of all, we've never found the electron.
Yeah.
Or pieces thereof, really. The women's skeleton and skull that they found is gone. They have measurements. Noonan's branded sextant box that they thought was on Nikumaru, they could never find that. The metal repair tag was 1055, never the New Britain theory by Billings.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Yeah, they had that tag, but that's gone. The patrol member who squalled the 1055, which was the reaction number,
right.
That's missing. The photo album of Amelia in Sport Dogs is found on Saipan, that's gone. The suitcase or briefcase is found on Legend. These are all alleged findings. They're all gone.
Yeah.
The blindfold is held, supposedly the blindfold is held by Brennan's son, but he doesn't think it's worth examining.
Right.
Our the file on Amelia Earhart supposedly found by Cochrane in the Daiichi Palace gone. Nobody knows what that is. Divine's handwritten note with NR16020 that he said he wrote down on Saipan. Never been able to produce that.
Yeah.
Wallach's briefcase. Nobody's ever found that. In other words, all these finds are only dependent upon witness testimony, and I just love to be able to bump into one of those.
Yeah, I can imagine that might be a smoking gun. All those potential smoking guns you just kind of rattled off are all missing. They're all gone. So
gone.
We're left with whatever else is out there and potentially out there. And I think it's been it keeps the case interesting.
Somebody said the 10-year diary they found on Amelia's 10-year diary, which I don't think she ever had, was found on Guadeloupe. They've never found that. And here's the most striking thing of all, is that Earhart was carrying in the nose something like 5,000 or 7,000, Bellart's nose is this, covers.
Yeah.
That she had stamped.
That's right.
In play. I would think if she went on land and that was seized by the Japanese or ended up, that Electra ended up at Oswego Field, that someone would have found one of those 7,000 covers.
Yeah. Yeah. That's very true. Yeah. 7,000 pieces. Yeah.
And we said we'd be convinced if somebody produces one of those covers held in her airplane.
Right. Yeah.
But again, these are things I say shoe may drop, something may be unclassified. There are people out there that are convinced that the president and the government is withholding information on Earhart. Although I can't understand now, years later.
But, yeah. And so the investigation and the mystery continues.
Well, I'm not really actively. Unless something develops independently, I don't know where to go. I don't know what to do.
Yeah. Wow.
A few people that have got the money. Les Kinney went out to Saipan.
Right. Yeah, interesting.
The Cole Denfield study of the inventory of Acevedo Field when they took it over in 1942, they didn't find any evidence of any, and there's a ton of photographs.
Yeah.
They didn't find any electric up there, but I don't know, sometimes these, I think they're, I guess it's my personal opinion, were invented, if you will.
Yeah.
But maybe someday somebody will come up with something.
Well, that's as good a point as any to end on. I want to really thank you, Ron, for your time. I know you have a lot going on, so thank you so much for sitting in on the podcast. As I said, personally for me, it's an absolute honor to have you aboard. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
I want to thank Ron for his time. He graciously gave us a lot of information regarding Earhart and the disappearance case. And like I said in the beginning, it's not often we get to do this kind of thing. So Ron, thank you very much. We're very happy to have had you on the show. Now, before we leave you this week, we want to talk about who's coming up next week on the Chasing Earhart podcast. Next week, our guest is Andrew McKenna of TIGER, the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery. He was the dive team leader at NICU this summer when TIGER went out and did their latest exploration. We talked with Andrew for quite some time about underwater maritime archaeology, about diving, about how everything like that plays into the Earhart investigation as far as the underwater wreckage is concerned. There's so many topics that we talked about as far as the Earhart Lockheed Electra plane, bringing that up out of the water wherever it lands and how that process is handled. It's a very interesting interview. We really go deep into the water, so to speak, with Andrew McKenna, and it's a very fascinating interview, and we're very excited to bring that to you. So that is next week, episode 17. We're moving right along here. My name is Chris Williamson. I want to thank you for joining us on the Chasing Earhart podcast this week. We will see you guys all in 7 days with Andrew McKenna in tow.